listening to the Audio Nowcast, sponsored by Westwave Audio, LA's new API dealer. And now from the Nowcast Network studios, here's Mike.
Hey, welcome to the Audio Nowcast. My name is Mike Rodriguez, and before we get going, let me introduce the guys. Over here to my right, I've got Martin Page.
How you doing, Mike?
Then we've got Scott Gershon.
Hello.
And we've got Rob Arbitier.
Hello, Mike.
Bobby is not with us.
Hello!
I'm shocked.
That's unusual.
And that's all we're going to say. He's not with us today. But
we still got the chair just sitting in the corner.
That's right. Yeah. We have his picture there, you know, the big.
Yeah, yeah.
Bobby will be back on the next podcast, he told me, so. Hey, but you know who is back, though? Andrew's back. Andrew's back.
Actually, we should clarify that's Andrew, our esteemed engineer.
Yes.
We have two Andrews who
we haven't seen
in the last few weeks.
Yeah, how's the other Andrew doing?
The other Andrew is doing well.
I think he went with Bobby somewhere.
Have you talked to Andrew?
I have, and he's doing great, and we'll be hearing from him soon.
I'm sure we will. He's
his career has exploded, and my guess is it's because of the podcast.
Yeah. Obviously.
Or in spite of, whatever.
We also have two really great guests with us today. We have Ken Kane.
Hello.
And we have Nick Kaskouris.
Hello.
And
can we stop fighting the urge to applaud?
You can add those. Yeah.
Ken and Nick are both freelance mixers, and I've worked with both of them, and they do a great job. And today on the podcast, on the top half, we're going to be talking a lot about a couple things I want to bring up. But the back half, we're going to be talking about jobs in audio. And today we're going to be talking about mainly post-production, and both Ken and Nick have great stories as far as how they got started. And I think it's going to be a pretty good show, showing people different ways that they can get into actually try to make a living at audio.
Don't cool. Do it.
Hey, before we get going, I wanted to tell you guys about a couple of things. Number one, picked up a great plugin. And actually, it was because I was over at Pagey Studio. And have you guys heard of Motu's Ethnic Instruments, that plugin?
Heard of it, but haven't heard it.
Oh, man. Martin, why don't you give a little rundown on your thoughts on that plugin?
It's a really good plugin because one of the greatest vibes about it is that some of the sounds don't feel too regulated when you loop them. It feels like it's really played by live players. It's got a looseness to it. All the samples sound very, very authentic. And I've been looking for some authentic Gaelic and Celtic sounds.
It's a virtual instrument plugin. Just want to let people know that.
And there's some Eulalian pipes in there, which I've been looking for a long time. They're very hard to sample. And I was very impressed. And when Mike came across and loaded it in for me, we played around with it for a while. And I think we were both impressed, weren't we, Mike?
Oh, the thing about it is, I don't know how much you've used ethnic instruments like any, bagpipes or even African drumming and djembes and things like that. But one of the hardest things to do is get a really good, not perfect loop. It sounds like I'm contradicting myself, but a lot of loops, you can hear the loop point and you can hear the timing. It's so perfect. And this is just a little, you know, it floats around the tempo, and it's just really phenomenal.
Yeah, I was very impressed. I think it's, you know, there's a lot of software that, you know, will say that it's doing, you know, African drums and ethnic sounds, but this is the best I've heard for a while.
Yeah.
I mean, is it MOS based, VST, RTAS?
You know what? It's all of them. I mean, I know it's RTAS and I know it's VST. Those are the only two that I use.
I'm sure it's based on their same sampler.
Yeah. Well, it's Motu, so it has to be a.
Is it Mach 5 based or is it?
You know what? I'm not sure what it is.
Probably at the engine level.
I would say the engine's probably the same. One of the cool things that you can do is if you're working with a loop, you could actually – there's a little space where you can click and drag, and it'll drag that loop into, like, if you're working on Acid or if you're working on Live. It'll drag the loop over, so now it turns into an audio region. Mm-hmm. And then that audio region you can work with. And that's really cool.
It's also great for educating you about geography as well, because it has a map there. And when you click on the country, up come the instruments that come
now
from that country.
Now that's cool.
Yeah.
Rarely do I find plugins that just jazz me as much as this one does, and it just is amazing. It sounds so good.
Can you change its original pitch, being the sound designer guy here?
You know, I haven't got into it enough. Possibly Mike knows more about
that
than I do.
You can pretty much tweak your samples any way that you can think of. I mean, you can change pitches, and it has an envelope.
Great reverbs as well.
Oh, the reverb is a convolution reverb, and you just pop it in, and it just adds just a just enough of a
sweetness. And what is the price tag on this puppy?
It wasn't too bad, actually. I think it's, some, you know, $240.
Yeah,
that.
$249. You
I'm definitely going to be checking decent. That out.
Yeah. It lists for $1,000, but because, you know, we are who we are, we got it for $249. No, just kidding. Actually, it lists for $100, and because we are who we are. No, it's $249. It's really great. Rob, what do you use for ethnic instruments? Do you use them much?
You know what I have?
Besides the real players.
Well, whenever we can, we use the real players, but I generally buy every one of those ethnic instrument plugins that comes out because even if there's only one or two good loops in the 10,000 it tells you about on the box, those things pay for themselves really, really fast. Mm-hmm. But more and more I have actually been finding the real players to come in and play things because there's nothing as authentic as the real thing.
Exactly.
Well, that's true.
And it's not that expensive a proposition if you're using it for real work. If you're just trying to mock up a demo or something, the libraries are great.
It's quite hard, though, to fly over a tribe of Africans, isn't it? It's quite expensive.
Yes, but you may be able to find a tribe of Africans in L.A. who'd be happy to do it, too. But, you know, there are plugins like Latigo and Darbuka and
– Oh, yeah. How are those?
They're great. Mm-hmm. And the ones from Yellow Tools, Culture, and all of those plug in ethnic libraries and just try to get what we can out of them. But, you know, on like even on Stevie Wonder's last album, a lot of the stuff was mocked up using plugins, and then he'd fly in the real people from around the world, which is something he can do.
Yeah.
And, you know, it's apples and oranges. There's nothing as cool as the real thing.
Yeah, the one thing I find that this plugin does is it provides you what you would pay for, which is those little nuances, those little soft hits, like on the djembe, and just it's phenomenal. It really is phenomenal.
So it just makes it sound more live?
Exactly.
More of a live recording?
Because it's imperfect. You know, sometimes when you're using like stylus and maybe a loop on top of that and everything's quantized, it just, you know, you get your sounds and they're just building on top of each other, and it just turns into
mush. We actually did that. We were working with stylus at the same time, and we were impressed that the loops on Ethnic just felt a little more loose. There was something about the edge.
And loose matters. You can't have everything pile up on every 16th note.
Yeah.
That's just not the way humans would actually play.
Exactly. Yeah. So it actually, it really works well with stylus because stylus
breaks it up,
can be right on the money. And then you've got like the djembe loop, which is just right around the, you know, the edges. And they just lay on top of each other really
A
nice.
Really cool thing to do too, if you have libraries of loops, not necessarily this Motu thing, but if you have a library of loops, ethnic loops from around the world, you can pull them into live and use the warp function. That's something I do a lot because a lot of the loops that I have in my library, the timing is not very – it's not at all quantized. You know, it's very kind of loose and human, but sometimes it's a little too loose. The way I deal with it, if you're not going to use something like recycle and slice it all up and resequence it, you can load it into live, put in warp markers, and actually just get things a little bit closer to the beat. I mean, when you need real flexibility, that's even better.
Tighten it up a little bit.
Yeah, you can tighten it up.
Yeah, the problem with like using Recycler and some of those ones that break the loops up is sometimes you can hear you lose that air and you hear that little gap thing.
Well, the trick is to try to use a loop that's a little bit slower than your song, so that each one of those slices generally has a little bit of a tail. Did I just give away a secret?
No, that's what it's about.
Hey.
Well, you know, especially doing percussion, getting percussion to sound like live is just – it's always been a
– Well, they have these things called percussionists. When in doubt.
Well, that's true too.
Yeah, they do a pretty good job.
Percussionists. I have to remember that.
Yeah, it's a plug-in.
Yes, but they also have these things called BFD.
And yeah, they do. And this thing called limited budgets, I understand.
So, well, the other plugin I got to talk about too is the from Waves is the GTR, the guitar package that they have with the little box from Paul Reed Smith. Although we bought actually Martin bought, I shouldn't say we because I didn't contribute a dime to the thing.
But you were there to put it in.
The native bundle because it was so much cheaper than the TDM, only to find out, and because I don't use RTAS that much, that you can't
do the live guitar and the effects to happen at the same time.
That is true.
Yeah. Wow. Yeah. It didn't really bother me, though, because I really bought that software because of I wanted to use the pedal board and the effects to play with the keyboard sounds. You know, like we were talking about real players, I have a couple of real amps and a real guitars, and so I tend to do the guitars through the Vox, and it feels that's the best way to do it. But you want to play with those keyboards and just dare I say muck them up. And I was very impressed with the Waves distortion and some of the pedal board. What's great about it is you can make your own stomp box. You can just bring in a wah-wah, then take that out and put another one in. And we were playing around with some keyboard sounds through it, and I was very impressed.
How does the guitar sound?
Sorry?
How does the guitar stuff sound through it?
Well, you see, as we were just saying, because it's we bought it through RTAS, you can't actually play...
Oh, right.
As you're playing the guitar, you can't get the effects coming up live. But if you've already recorded a live
feels
guitar...
gone.
Yeah.
Well, you know what?
Well,
here, I can speak from that other perspective, because we use it TDM all the time.
Yeah.
And it's a great way to do guitar.
Yeah.
Because what you're doing... Basically, or the way we use it is we'll record the guitar to a track and then monitor through the amp and through the stomp box. But what that means is that the signal that's recorded to disc is the clean guitar.
Mm-hmm. Right.
So even in the mix, we can still change the amps and the stomp boxes. Another thing that's really cool is if you have a good MIDI controller for pedals, like I use the Vox Tone Lab pedal for guitar a lot, which is a great pedal. It has a tube in it that's actually implemented well. It sounds great. It's a great effects box, but it's also a MIDI controller.
Mm-hmm.
So the two pedals on that Vox Tone Lab, you take the MIDI out, send the MIDI into Pro Tools, and then you can control the wah-wah and the stomp box of the GTR plugin from an actual physical pedal.
Mm-hmm.
And the response is great. I don't know what the RTAS response would be like, but the TDM response is great. I mean, we have guitar players play through it live all the time, whereas we can't do that if we try to run the Native Instruments guitar stuff, guitar rig.
Right. Mm-hmm.
On RTAS, it's too slow. Our guitar players just look at us like,
"Yeah,
you must be crazy." But the Wave stuff is very fast, very responsive, and if you use the MIDI controller pedals, it's really cool, and it sounds good.
Do you use the Paul Smith?
Yeah, actually, we do use that little Paul Reed Smith direct box thing is really good.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, I've gone back and forth. Sometimes I've used, actually, Aphex mic pre's with it and guitar pre's.
Mm-hmm.
When I needed a little bit just better control, and I like the I don't know, I like the sound of the Aphex stuff, but I go back and forth.
Yeah.
The little Paul Reed Smith thing sounds really, really excellent.
Mm-hmm.
Can you?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, it's a direct. It's great. Now, VST, do you think you could use that live as a VST if you had the native?
I think so, yeah.
Because it just – why can't you use it on RTAS?
Well, I'd have to explore. I think
I mean, I know RTAS doesn't do it, and I'm just thinking that's just really lame that you can't do that with RTAS.
Well, I wonder if there's a way to route it where you could do it with RTAS.
We tried. I did AUXes. As soon as I did an input, as soon as I opened it up.
Right, it kills the RTAS.
It kills it.
You've got it on.
Well, you know what?
You're doing 7.2?
You'd hate it anyway.
Virtual 7.2.
It'd be way too slow.
No. You got it on TDM, right?
On TDM, yeah. It would be way too slow on RTAS anyway, even if it did work.
But when Pro Tools 7.2, because it now opens up RTAS to AUX.
Mm-hmm.
Inputs where before it didn't.
Yeah, I think that would work, but I think you'd also probably find its latency is annoying.
So RTAS
latency is not great. Yeah. RTAS latency is not a great thing.
Yeah, because VST is really quick and fast,
mm-hmm.
and so I just can't believe RTAS would be that far behind.
Well, you must learn to believe.
I guess so.
That's the quickest way to solve the problem.
But I will tell you, hands down, when we did a comparison, and especially on the distortion between the Native Instruments Guitar Rig 2
mm-hmm.
and Waves, it's just Waves distortion is just – it's rounder. It sounds a little more full, a little richer.
Yeah.
It doesn't have that – sometimes you can hear that. Even on like Amp Farm and some of the other plugins – their distortion gets a little like sawtooth. It has that.
I'd say you'd also find the best results with the Wave stuff. I like when you use the amps that have dual speaker cabinets.
Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm. That gets a much more realistic sound for us than the single speaker.
What about Amplitube? Have you tried that?
Yeah. Amplitube is excellent, but it's a different kind of animal. Amplitube's much more like a
one
crazy
or two, one or two.
Box.
Amplitube one or two.
Either or. I think that. Amplitube is much more of like an extreme plaything to me than the Wave stuff strikes me as more conservative and realistic.
Right.
It's definitely.
But I love Amplitube. I use it all the time.
Fine.
It's the Waves thing is the kind of plugin literally, we were throwing absinthe through it. We were throwing everything through it, and it all sounded good. Mm-hmm. It all sounded just grungy and just a lot of textures, but it didn't sound bad. It never gave us that sawtooth, you know, we're going electric now.
And you know what? It's amazing to be able to change your amp settings after the fact, because once you've done a bunch more overdubs after guitar, mm-hmm. a lot of times you'll wish, I wish that guitar was a little more distorted or less distorted or whatever. And because you've recorded the clean signal, you have that control. And I will say that it's still, you know, when you reamp a guitar, even if you use a proper reamp box and you come off a Pro Tools track and you're reamping through real amps, it's never quite the same as what you first heard when you recorded the amplified sound.
Yeah.
And with the guitar plugin, obviously it is the same from time to time.
It reminds me of the sound that Peter Gabriel would use on Talk to Me if it was around back then, because you could get that really good, you know, because to get that distorted sound.
You know, they were using A3s on that.
On that
Peter Gabriel track, it was an A3. Because I met the engineer and I asked him about that distortion.
Because
he said it's a keyboard sound going through an A3.
Yeah,
yeah.
That was because that's like, I love that sound.
It's a great sound, actually.
Great sound.
And it's a very, very linear, smooth sound, but the distortion is cool.
Wow, and he got that out of an A3?
A3 with a keyboard sound. And the actual keyboard sound, for what's interesting about this, came from a, it was a D, what was a D50 box that you actually had in Iraq?
D550. D550.
Yeah, and it was the...
you need one?
Organ guitar sound. You know, that's a pretty good sound in that box, going through the Wave 3 that made that Peter Gabriel sound.
What's the A3?
It's an old guitar processor.
Okay.
It's a bit like, it was like the next stage up.
From the Korg?
From a Rockman, yeah.
Yeah, yeah.
Yeah.
Okay.
How similar to the Korg A1 was it?
I wouldn't know.
Maybe two better.
Two better.
Sorry, were you going to take that line?
Okay. It's a game. I'll give it to you, man.
Thank you.
Your delivery's better.
Thank you.
All right, well,
so much for this being a post show.
Listen to the audio podcast.
The post show's after it's post.
Oh, I
that's
see.
Right.
Gotcha.
But, so I just wanted to talk to you guys and mention those two plugins and everybody else out there. Go out and buy them. Not that we get a cut of anything, but
I was going to say. We need to work some kind of deal.
Hey, yeah, man. Call 512-37.
You got to support the brothers when they have a good product out there. Also, what I wanted to bring up with you guys is I picked up, I don't know if any of you guys read computer.
We do read. Yes,
we do. I don't know if any of you guys read. No, the Computer Music Magazine, but they have a great issue, a special on mixing. And they right at the very top, they ask a really interesting question that I want to just bring to you guys really quick. And they ask the question, what is mixing? And it's a great article. It's a great magazine. They give great advice throughout the whole thing, and people should pick this one up also. But I don't get a cut of that either. So, but I want to start with you, Rob. I want to know. Give me your definition of mixing. What is mixing?
I was going to ask them, what is a magazine? While we're asking questions. I don't know what the hell mixing is. It's taking a bunch of stuff that doesn't seem to go together and making it go together. If everything as you're working on, I mean, coming from a music perspective, if everything works perfectly together as you're building up a track, you don't need much mixing because you're mixing it as you go and everything sounds great. To me, the real art of mixing is taking things that don't seem to go together that well and making them go together. That's the basic definition of mixing to me. And then there's another level of mixing, which is real artistry and creativity. And that's getting a sound that whoever put together the original tracks didn't even envision, you know, taking it to the next level with outboard gear and doing something creative. But to ask what is mixing is, I guess it's a provocative question, but there's not even just one kind of mixing. There are a zillion kinds of mixing.
Right.
Did I take the air out of that balloon too much?
No, you know what? Because when somebody asks me what is mixing, the way I answer that question is I say basically when you mix, you manage energy. You're managing sound energy.
That's deep.
But it's true. You have, you know, you can, you know, you've got a pipeline where you can get a certain amount of energy through it. And
well, there's technical mixing, which is just making things – which is managing energy and just making things behave together within a sound, you know, within a final mix. But mixing, if done well, can be a much more creative.
Well, absolutely. I mean, you got to
you have to know the technical limitations of what you're doing. And
but essentially, don't you think that mixing is essentially you're managing energy?
Yeah, I mean, as a technical definition, yeah. I think that is.
I think it's also the word balance is, you know, you're taking sounds or and you're balancing them into a place where you're happy with that sound. As Rob was saying, it's hard to define because everybody hears something a little bit different. But the way I can see it as well is if you've got multiple sounds, more than one, you're looking for a balance that pleases you or might excite somebody. You know, balance comes into it.
Pleasing the client.
Is that
mixing?
Which is hard.
That's successful mixing.
Right. Turn the subwoofer up.
From a post side of it, making the picture sound better.
There you go.
Yeah, bring it to life.
Well, there you go. Scott, what is mixing?
Mixing for me is audio sculpting. In that you deal with three dimensions because you deal with frequency, you deal with volumes of those frequencies, you deal with tone, you deal with negative space, which I think is really important because when you start with a square block and you start carving things away, certain things start revealing themselves, and it's a combination. Yeah, to me it's very much like sculpting. You know, when you look at a mixing console – like, I'm very sensitive of how the faders feel and how the knobs feel because, like an instrument, you start playing it and you start feeling the sound and how to push it. And I don't know, it becomes a attachment between what you hear and your hands. You're not thinking about, I'm going to move this 2 dB. Your hands start doing things on the console, and you don't even think about what you're doing. You just go and transcend. God, this is unearthly. You transcend what you're doing, and I do think it is an instrument. And, you know, I do believe a lot in negative space mixing, in carving things out, because what I find is when certain people mix additively, you start masking certain frequencies and certain sounds. A lot of times when I start mixing and I'll throw everything up, kind of listen to it and analyze it, and then I start carving frequencies out, thus showing other frequencies, and it's an explorer. You just explore and see what the piece wants to be to you.
Wow. That's pretty good. I like that.
Mm-hmm. I think that's the best explanation. So,
yeah. So, okay, can you sum that up in four words again?
Watching grass grow.
Yeah, the thing is, if you're not actually doing the mixing, it is watching grass grow.
Yes, it is. Well, hey, if anybody wants to send us an email at audio@nowcastnetwork.com, that's audio@nowcastnetwork.com, tell us what you think mixing is. Okay, we want to know what is mixing. So, well, that pretty much just brought this whole show to an end.
Mixing is entertainment death.
Things not to do in a podcast. What is mixing?
Good subject. That was a good question. Yeah.
No, but it really is, and it's actually it's a great article. It's a great issue if you've mixed for a while or even if you're just starting out. I wanted to bring that up because I know there's a lot of people out there that are just
starting
out.
What was the name of the magazine?
It's Computer Music. Their Computer Music Special, Mixing, Volume 19, magazine and CD, $15.99.
Oh, wow.
$15.99. Holy. All right. Well, speaking of mixing, I just want to introduce you guys, and I know we're going to talk a little bit more on the second half. Ken Kane over here, he's a freelance mixer. I work with Kane on a couple of different TV shows. And Ken, why don't you just give a little brief bio on how you got into mixing? Because after the break, we're going to talk about getting a job in audio.
Brief bio. All right. I played in bands all my life, toured around. Went to studios, recorded music with my band. And I had an opportunity to come up here and work in a post studio. My dad knew a GM. I came up through the shipping department. I met a guy over there. He took me under his wing, and that's basically it, Persistence, a lot of hard work, late nights. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, that's the definition.
Okay,
basically.
Now let me fill in a little detail.
You said quick bio before the break.
I know. Well, I met Ken.
That's the gist.
Because yeah. you were working in the vault too, weren't you? Or were you just
at chipping? CCI?
Over at
Wood Holly.
Yeah.
Yeah, I worked in the vault.
He worked in the vault. He wanted to get into audio. He met another mixer, and we brought Ken in. He learned Pro Tools. And then we brought Ken in, started to do some editing for us. And he had a great work ethic, and he did a really great job.
He knows me better than
I mean, you were 12.
No. But the great thing is he worked his way up, and he recently, right now, he's mixing Animal Planet show.
Animal Atlas. It's a national show. It's on Fox out here.
Yeah. So, you know.
26 episodes.
Exactly. And and so I just thought, you know, when we talk about it, we'll talk a little bit more about how we made the jumps to the different levels. Also, I want to introduce, you know, Nick again. And Nick, why don't you give us a brief little bio on how you got going?
Well, my bio is kind of different. I'm not a musician. I never thought I was going to be in this entertainment industry. And then I was on a path of trying to be a mathematician, which, you know, I loved math growing up and numbers, and that's kind of what I thought I was going to do. And then one day I had an idea of being something else, you know, and getting into entertainment. So I did that. I started off as a teleprompter operator. And then I met a guy that did sound for Laker games, Kings games, Dodger games, just the local sports teams, and basically said, hey, come on down. And if you want to learn how to do sound, come on down and check it out, because I'm going to be going out of town for a couple weeks and I need someone to cover for me. So I was like, okay. So me being a Laker nut kind of went down there and learned the audio world of broadcast. Wow. Wiring, basically, you know, remote trucks, setting up and tearing down a studio every day. And, you know, it was backbreaking work at first, but, you know.
And did you end up stealing his job?
No, I didn't end up stealing his job.
It's a much better story if you did.
Yeah. You know, I worked with him for quite a while, for a couple years, and, you know, he was very helpful. And I kind of just – that's how I sort of got into the audio world. And I always liked sound anyway. When I was a little kid, I used to try and build speakers because my dad wouldn't buy me a speaker. So I built a speaker with spare parts. But, you know, that's that was my jump into the audio world. And then obviously it's kind of gone – from there.
The big question I want to ask you is, being a teleprompter operator, are you responsible for the speed of the words coming
out?
Oh,
yeah. Yeah. No, that was a fun job, actually. You know, you got to learn a lot of things, actually. My job was to just type the script in and basically sit for the talent, you know, wait for the talent. So I got to watch to see what everyone else was doing. So
so you didn't control the speed?
No, I did.
Did you? Did you ever, like, go fast and go slow or go too
fast? You get yelled
at
if you went too fast. But, you know, it was fun. I got to meet a lot of cool people and famous people. So that was fun, you know. And then I just kind of moved on from that. You know, I didn't think I was going to, you know. It wasn't a career path I wanted, so I wanted to do something different, a little bit more artistic. So,
well, I'll tell you what, we're going to take a break, and when we come back on the other side, we're going to talk a little bit more with Nick and Ken, and also talk a little bit about getting employed, being employed, staying employed, and some horror stories about working in the audio industry. All right, we'll see you on the other side.
Have a question for the panel? Would you like to be a guest on the Audio Nowcast and live in the LA area? Email us at audio@nowcastnetwork.com.
Hey, welcome back to the Audio Nowcast. And we're going to talk a little bit about getting employed in the audio industry. And the reason why we're talking about that is it seems we get a lot of email and a lot of people ask, well, how did you get started or what's the first couple steps? And especially in the post side of things. So I brought Nick and my friend Ken, who are both freelance mixers, over here so we can talk a little bit about that. And then we've got Scott, who works in post-production. And Martin's going to sit here and be a really good audience.
Because I have nothing to do with this at all.
And I know Rob – well, actually, Rob, you're going to, you know, I know you're starting. You've done a couple little post things.
We've been doing more mixing stuff, yeah.
More and more post things. Nick, why don't you talk about some of the problems that you had actually when you first started mixing, and when you first started doing your first couple of jobs as a mixer, and when you started.
Well, I started off as an editor, and when I got into the post world, knew someone, got in, and then what I would do is I would edit and then go to mixes and watch, and right. I had no idea what was going on. I just thought, you know, the board looked really intimidating to me. I edited for probably about 3 years, and then finally got a mixing job for features. And then when I got on the board, I wasn't as intimidated because I had watched people, get on it. And
now, when you talk about editing, why don't you explain to people what you were doing as an editor? What exactly editing what?
I was doing theatrical trailers, pretty much. We get a tape on a three-quarter inch tape, and then we have to reproduce it on film. So I would get a tape with just music and dialogue, and then mostly I would do the effects, clean up the dialogue, clean up music cuts, and then just cut everything else that needed to be cut, blank spaces, dead spots, and alternate door slams, and car skids, and have as much as I thought was needed. You'd have four car skids just in case the producer didn't like one of them. He could have options on the stage. Because basically back then there was not the, digital was just getting started. I just, probably like 94, 95, just got started. So, you had mags back there. So right. You'd have to be in sync actually. So you wouldn't be able to just slide it on the stage. So if something was out of sync or they wanted to cut, I'd have to run back to the studio and cut it and then bring it back. They'd have to transfer it and blah, 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 blah. And, after a while, you learn to cut, be precise. I did that for a while and then jumped into the mixing world.
Now, Ken, you also started off as an editor.
Exactly.
And tell us a little bit about when you...
I missed the whole mag thing, though.
Right.
I'm kind of disappointed. It sounded like a lot of fun.
No, no, it wasn't. ask Scott. Scott, was it fun?
I was the absolute worst mag cutter. I was actually told that thankfully I was really good electronically because they thought it was probably the worst mag cutter on the planet. So.
What does that entail? I don't even know. I mean, like this?
Yeah, well, I mean...
Straight splice, angle splice.
Well,
that's what it is?
Well, I used to cut on a digital system, but we used to transfer to mag because basically we'd mix with mag in the theater world. So it was you have to cut it, transfer it to tape, and then they transfer it to film, and then go ahead and start mixing that way.
Amazing.
So it's now since then that those stages have gone to digital and
right.
They can just slide things and
people were working in their living rooms.
Yeah, exactly.
So Ken,
yeah,
your first edit session. Tell us a little bit about that.
I edited a show called Clean Sweep, hour long reality show. I did dialogue. I think the biggest problem I had was figuring out, what was okay, what wasn't okay. I mean, I'd spend 12 hours cutting and it took a while and I got the hang of it.
Okay. Well, since I can talk on the other side, I was actually getting a lot of the stuff that Ken was editing.
Oh,
because I was mixing the shows that Ken was editing.
Terrible. The first week.
No, actually, you're really good. But the reason why I want to bring this up, the editing, is because if you want to get a job in audio, especially – now, this is Los Angeles. I don't know how it is for other places. Apparently, Austin has a really big Nuendo crowd. But in Los Angeles, really – Pro Tools. I mean,
that was the best $600 I ever spent.
Would you guys agree that Pro Tools, if you learn Pro Tools, that's probably the first marketable piece of software skill set that you could offer
somebody?
Well,
at this point, that's like know how to use a 24-track tape machine.
Exactly.
Yeah, you got to know it.
Well, back in the day, there was AudioVision, there was Fairlights.
Right. There were 52
there was more than that. Yeah, there was
Waveframe.
A ton of them. Yeah, there you go. You guys can just keep going. I mean, I was it was mostly audio vision and Fairlights. And
yeah.
So I had to learn, I tried to get as much time as I could on those, just so that if someone calls me for a job, do you know how to work on this? Yeah, I know how to work on it. You know, even if I just know a little bit,
right.
At least I can say I know how to work on it.
You never want to lose a job because you didn't know how to use the gear.
I always lie about that.
So even though if you go on a lot of the boards and you see, you know, always, you know, Pro Tools versus Nuendo versus Sonar versus Logic, if you want to get employed, learn Pro Tools. If you want to get a job, learn Post, but also I would say music too. I mean, someone's either comp into Pro Tools or you're converting off of Pro Tools.
Right.
I mean, Rob, you do music, mm-hmm. Pro Tools?
Well, partially. I mean,
it's in there though, right?
Music is more of a world where you need to know a few of them.
Well, that's really. True too.
But yeah, if you have to pick one platform and you're in a neighborhood where Pro Tools is what everybody else is using, I always tell people, learn whatever it is you need to learn to get the job. And if you're doing it for yourself, learn what your friends know, because then you have people you can go to for right. help. And
yeah. Like, I was asked to learn Logic, and I've never really had any experience with it. And yeah, I mean, now it's just a matter of trying to find time to kind of learn how to do it, because now I'm pretty busy, so I mean, the last thing I want to do is go home and start learning another.
Well, one thing though about learning different platforms is a lot of times, like say you know Pro Tools really well,
mm-hmm.
and then you go and learn Logic, and Logic works completely different.
Right.
But you realize there are a few features in Logic that are pretty cool.
Yeah, exactly.
And it may be you never had the idea of even trying to do something like that in Pro Tools, and then when you go back to Pro Tools, you realize, wait a minute, there is actually a way to do this really cool thing that I learned about in Logic. So you can learn a different platform, right. and it'll teach you stuff about
right.
your first platform.
Right.
That happens to me all the time. I try to stay current with all of them, mm-hmm. with Logic and Cubase and Pro Tools and Digital Performer.
What do you enjoy the most working on?
Huh? Yeah, which one is the most?
I enjoy making fun of Digital Performer, actually. You know, I mean, for sequencing and MIDI and all that stuff, I've used Cubase and Nuendo for a long time because I just think they're the best for that.
Do you use Pro Tools more as a
recorder? I use Pro Tools as the audio recorder. That's my console. I mean, we mix in it using the dithered mixer, which I think sounds fine. So I use, I guess you could say that Nuendo is the musical instrument and Pro Tools is the recording mixer
right.
device. And they work well together. You know, they sit side by side. They're synchronized perfectly. And I've learned to use each product better by understanding the other.
Right.
I also think, though, that, I mean, since we're talking about Post, you still have to learn Harrison, Euphonics, and Neve. I think those are the standards. I mean, Pro Tools is
great.
If you're
going to be in that league, though.
I'd love to do that. I mean,
we're just talking about mixing and post-production.
Yeah. Right, right. No, that would be something.
I mean, because there's still a lot of places that have it. And Pro Tools now, in my opinion, is only just starting to break the corner on doing some real mixing.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, with 7.2 was pretty impressive. But before that, I thought it was a really cool editing device that could mix. But it wasn't a great mixer.
When you're in that league with the big dubbing stages and big theatrical.
Definitely. But even TV, I mean, you know.
Yes, I mean,
when you look at a lot of the, you know, scripted shows and.
Well,
I mean, the shows that have a lot of dynamic and a lot of diversity both in music effects and dialogue.
Yeah.
And, you know, just because you're dealing with a lot of tracks, with Pro Tools, you're dealing with one session. And whatever you fit in that session. But when you start starting to deal with four Pro Tools systems, because you've got a music editor's doing his thing, a dialogue editor's doing his thing,
right.
and you've got 64 to 100 tracks of sound effects, and you're dealing with 5.1, all of a sudden, Pro Tools doesn't look all that great.
Hmm.
I mean, it really doesn't service those needs that well. I mean, you could put two icons together, three icons.
Well, but it's basically replacing a room full of 24-track tape machines.
Oh,
right?
Absolutely. No. We definitely, I think, for prepping and becoming the tape machine, it's definitely there. And I think it's seriously heading towards being a mixing solution. But if you've ever start putting a lot of the stuff in these Pro Tools sessions, they start bogging down.
Yeah.
Then you got digital picture. I mean, I've literally could take a Pro Tools system even, you know, the latest, greatest, and make it come to its knees.
Mm-hmm.
You know, 192 tracks, 24-bit, 48, with video, a ton of plugins, hit play, 1, 2, 3. Then it starts playing.
Right.
You know.
The beach ball is fun to sit
Absolutely.
Watch.
Yeah. You get to see a lot of beach ball.
All right, well, what we'll say is we'll learn Pro Tools and some other tools. That's going to be our
first. Learn whatever is the is the key tool in your area. Right. I mean, if you're sitting in Germany, but it could be a totally different.
But you know, if you've but realistically, you know, if you're gonna, like I said, for Los Angeles, and if you're gonna get into any. Just to get your
in
foot
Los
in the door.
Angeles, but Mike, we're worldwide.
But, no.
But even LA, London, New York, Atlanta. About,
yeah. Well,
I mean CNN. I mean,
what I'm saying, we're starting here, kids. We're starting. The first piece of advice I'd give anybody who wants to get into audio: learn Pro Tools. That's
if
just.
If you're in Burbank, absolutely.
And I'll take it one separate. All those wonderful Mackie mixers, those O2Rs, all those Yamaha consoles that have sends,
right.
Buses, and outputs. I mean, I think that you have to know those things, and I think that if you want to grab a good foundation, you need to understand I/O, you need to understand, you know, XLRs, quarter-inch plugs, TRS plugs, patch bays. I mean, Pro Tools doesn't have any of that.
Well, this is the thing I also think about, too, is, I mean, I was fortunate because I got to play with wires, you know, and not a computer screen. So if you sit there and you say that you have to learn Pro Tools to mix, I think you have to actually learn how the process is done.
The concept
of it, the theory behind it, because then you can add to it. Because if you put someone in a broadcast truck and you go ahead and mix a show, they're going to look at that patch bay and go, wow, and then look to the side of it and see the little map of the patch bay, then, yeah, that's a big
you're
thing.
Absolutely right. And the only reason why I'm saying is learning Pro Tools is because of the career path that you can take where you can get in with Pro Tools, all right, and you can start editing. And I'm not talking about you're going to jump into the truck because, obviously, number two on my list on getting a job in audio is first you learn a tool like Pro Tools, all right, then you got to find some friends. Yeah. I mean, right now, I don't know. I know I was, you know, I looked for a friend, basically. Actually, the friend found me that got me into audio. I mean, how many of you guys, you know, was a friend or an acquaintance that got you into the
Yeah, it was. I mean, it was someone I met on the set, so.
I don't know. Scott, how did you get into audio? Did you have was there a key friend that got you into the
I take a different path, and my recommendation is a little bit different.
Sure.
I went to Berklee College of Music. And in the summertime,
good school.
Between school, I actually was a live sound mixer at Disneyland. I started doing lighting design and live sound mixing at Disneyland.
Right.
And what was interesting during that 4-year passage, I really got a chance to learn live sound. We were dealing with consoles, MCIs, SSLs. Then you go to any kind of studio. I started in the music biz. What is that? Understanding it, looking at outboard gear, what's that? Asking questions, asking experts to find out what their thoughts were. And the principles are very much the same, but I do believe that I'm a little more traditional. I think that if you want to become a mixer in LA and you're starting from scratch, there are some wonderful institutions out there that you can go to get a head start. Because it is a little more complex. And I think that you need to understand busing structures and gain structures and unity gain and you know, all of that type of thing. Because I think what's important, I think, in education for somebody in this industry is to come in with as much trivial information that you think you may not use within the first 2 years. But as you progress, like I was a synthesist and I sat there and said, wow, envelopes are like noise gates. And noise gates are like envelopes. All of a sudden, you looked at the synth world and you looked at the audio world, and they're the same world. They just call things different. So I think that, you know, modulators on LFOs can be choruses on outboard gear, can be, you know, the way they are in synths, and learning really good basic audio.
Now, was there any person that helped you cross the line from where you were to where you are now? I mean, was there anybody? It just seems to me when I'm not talking about the tools because that's actually my next step. But it seems to me is you need to find somebody, you need to find a contact, you need to find a way to actually get your foot into that door, even before what you know, because you may know a lot, but if you can't show what you know or talk to anybody that you know, that's why I think it's important. You know, user groups nowadays, you know, getting jobs in post facilities at, like, you know, working in the vault and things of that nature. You know, being an intern,
it's never going to change that. You need to start.
Sure, but you know what? Someone said this to me early on, and we've hired a lot of people, and we have a pretty big crew. And, you know, when I started, there were 10 of us, and now there's, I don't know, 4,000 of us. And the thing is, it's not what when everybody starts, they start the same. Yes, they start in the vaults. They start in these places. After the first year, kind of actually reminds me of Berkeley. Everyone who, you know, was better at what they played. What happens is how fast you move ahead of the other guy is all going to be based on what you knew before you came in. Mm-hmm. So if you didn't have any MIDI experience or anything like that, with a guy that knew MIDI, knew synths, knew this, knew outboard gear, he's flying forward really fast,
right?
Because he's got all this knowledge. It doesn't mean that if you don't know it, you won't have it. But trying to get as much knowledge, you got to live at AES conventions. You got to live at NAMM. You got to understand it. You've got to go to Guitar Center or any music store, park your butt down there, try every piece of gear, listen to the speakers, and really invest your time and your love in the artistry of what you want to do.
Right. You know what I would say? Everything about, let's say, Pro Tools with all the plugins and everything else it does as a mixer and a recorder and everything else, every single aspect of Pro Tools is in some way emulating a piece of gear or a concept that's been valid in the audio industry for a long time. Compressors, limiters, faders, you know,
demo
hand
every
pots.
Piece of software you've had.
Well, the thing is, though, the people who are going to do best are going to be the people who understand the concepts and have had some hands-on experience with the gear that Pro Tools is actually emulating.
Right.
You're going to have a better understanding of the recording process if you've actually dealt with a signal path through a mixer into a tape machine. And there are schools that still emphasize that stuff that always end up taking you to the point where you're working in Pro Tools and high-end digital systems, but they'll take you through aligning a tape machine and what that means. They'll take you through using a real compressor and understanding what that means. I think you're always going to have a better shot. Because what happens if another platform comes out right now that looks and acts nothing like Pro Tools, but also has compressors and faders and everything else? If you just know Pro Tools as if it was the beginning of the recording world, you're really robbing yourself of a lot of really valuable information.
Well,
and I was lucky to start out with, you know, a situation where I was able to use the old gear before switching to the new, and it's invaluable.
Absolutely, but I'm also, you know, we're living in a world where you see guys come in all the time that they get their inbox, they start learning the plugins. They've never even worked in a real console before, but they're getting a job. I'm not discounting what you guys are saying. Absolutely, you need to learn all those. You know,
I don't see how you can progress that far if you really don't know the fundamentals.
Well, I'll tell you how you can progress that far. Easy. You get an inbox. You learn how to work your inbox. You find a friend who wants to hire you as a editor. He teaches you how to edit. You start editing. Meanwhile, you're watching him do your mixing. Next thing you know, you learn a little bit about mixing, a little bit about compression. You talk to him. Boom, you can find, you know, there's a gazillion small post houses in L.A. that are looking for people that know how to just manage volumes. And next thing you know it, you're on a show. I mean, that happens all the time without ever even seeing a big console, let alone, you know, going without even touching a fader.
You're right. You can go that path.
But you're limiting.
I know what you're going to say.
Absolutely.
What was I want to ask Guy, the last $100 million feature mixed by a guy who learned on an inbox? Name it.
You know what? Actually, though, if you want to take that route, some of the best mixers that I know all came from music. I mean, they all came from the record biz. And I think, really, if you want to start mixing, grab the chorus from your guitar or your keyboard. Start understanding that. If your vocalist understand volume and PAs, then as you progress and you grow, it gets more complicated. And then I think, though, what you want to try to do, and honestly, it's very competitive. I mean, yes, there's a lot of places in Hollywood, but, you know, it's a very expensive place to live, and it's very, very competitive. And you want to try to learn as much as you can while you're younger, where you have nothing to lose, and to try to get as much information as you can, which will then thrust you through the rest of your career and give you those opportunities that are available based, to be honest, on the fundamental information you
learn. I don't care what system you're learning on or what kind of work you're hoping to do. There's no substitute for experience.
No, you're absolutely –
and for real knowledge.
You're absolutely right. There is no substitute for that.
I mean, it doesn't mean you can't get some gig, but, I mean, we're trying to aspire to have something better than some gig.
I think what Mike is saying, though, is real, though, because, you know, we came robbed right from the analog world right back then. There's some kids coming up that are, like, you know, much, much younger.
But there's nothing stopping them
from getting a book and reading about it or bumping into somebody, but not everybody has a student. tuner in their house or has a board.
No, no, but if their goal is to truly be excellent as a mixer or an editor or anything
but
else.
But you know what? You're going to see mixers that are going to come all the way up and may even mix a $100 million $100 million movie and never ever work on the old school gear. Never.
I'm not saying
they
have to work on the old school gear. I'm saying they need to understand the concept.
But see, the thing is with Pro Tools on the compressor, you get the same concept of what compression does on a plugin, looking at how the VUs work.
Right, and that's the way Pro Tools is right now. But what if Pro Tools...
Well, I'm just saying compression as a concept can be learned on software. I'm not saying it's better. You know me. I'm discovered analog. I love all the analog gear. I love all the wires. I love all that. You know, and I grew up. I do. It's like, when I was touring, I got a buzz out of putting together racks and stuff.
Oh,
but,
it's fun. But it's electronically fun. That's an art, too. It's artistic
as
well. But,
you know, I came from the analog world, and I've been doing this for a while. And then when you put the Pro Tools system in for me and I started to play around with software, I started to learn some things about new software old processes that I didn't know about. And I've been doing 20 years in analog. Mm-hmm. So it was almost like a slightly different language.
Additional knowledge is never bad.
Well, you're going to have to keep learning over and over. I mean, that's just a huge part, too. Yeah.
But there are people who think that Pro Tools is – the entire history and technique.
Yeah, you're right.
You're
right. There's a lot of.
But you know, you go in Barnes and Noble, and you just look at the audio books down the side of Barnes and Noble, and you'll see books there that will teach you about compression and about the old way that mastering was done and how to master. And if you want to just take some of those books home, which I've done, they really do give you a feel, even if you haven't been working in the analog world.
But you know, it's also, I think it's the artistry of mixing also is the feel. And that is using your ears. I mean, you can intellectualize everything. Yeah. I mean, it's interesting. When I first started, I intellectualized compressors and limiters. And I kept hearing about all these people. Like, when I first used an 1176, I thought it sucked. Because I said, well, it's pumping, and I don't like the sound. And everyone's going, oh, you get sustain. I'm like, what do you mean sustain? It's a limiter. There's no sustain. And I didn't understand it because I was thinking logically.
Yeah.
And then when I started learning how to use compressors creatively, it opened up a whole other world, especially when you start talking about multi-band compressors. Mm-hmm. All of a sudden, wow, you start shaping sounds in really interesting ways. But I do agree in the fact that one great thing about using an MBOX or Pro Tools is that I would recommend downloading every demo possible and then getting an idea, why is an LA-2A different than 1176 plugin or from a Renaissance compressor? Or, I still do that to this day. I'll grab mixes. I'll throw different plugins in to see, I go to the ones that are fast, that I know the clients will like and it'll be great. But then sometimes I'll go, hey, what about this?
Yeah.
Right.
And I find, a lot of experimenting, a lot of listening.
But one of the things you're saying here that I think everybody at the table is saying, when we all got involved, we have tremendous enthusiasm and naive enthusiasm because we love music. And I think that's one of the things. We just kept on looking. You've got to want to love to do it. You can read books. You can, have friends that help you. And obviously, this is very important. But we were all so enthusiastic about music or sounds to some form. And we kept on going.
One of the things that has I'll make this quick. One of the things that always frustrates me, because one of the things I do a lot of is artist development and helping people, find what it is they're great at or try to work on that. And, you could use Pro Tools and use an approximation of an LA-2A, which is great, and the approximation is great. But anybody who does that and ignores the fact that maybe they should also just check out a real LA-2A just to hear what the difference is. I'm not saying you have to go out and spend a bunch of money, but, a real LA-2A still sounds better. And that's true with most plugins. The real thing still sounds better. It's fine to learn how to do all this stuff on an MBOX, but if you want to have a real high-end career, don't rob yourself of the opportunity to hear the gear that some of this stuff is modeling.
Right.
And because, it's still better. The computer still can't make it exactly
the same.
And I also
think what you said, Scott, about being artistic, I think, mixing is artistic. It's not scientific. There's a ton of ways to get to the same outcome. Where science is there's only one way. So, and I think the Pro Tools gives you that, there's a template, so whatever the template is, that's how you got to do it. I mean, there's a million ways to mix, and that's what you've got to understand. There is sort of an art to it, and everyone does it a different way. No one does it the same way, but, the outcome is a final mix that everyone
as long as you learn the scientific the rules that you have to work within. Right. Yeah,
there's limitations.
And
there's obviously scientific limitations, yeah.
And there's also the business side. I had a wonderful opportunity 1 year that I was transitioning. I was still doing my music. And I was working at Cherokee Studios on some days. And I was working for a guy named Pete Woodford, who was with The Tonight Show, a guitar player, at his studio in Granada Hills. Okay, so when I'm at the Cherokee Studios, we would spend literally a day or two listening to amps, and let's grab Lukather's head, and he's got like the red one, and let's use that bottom. And we played, and we really like listened to sounds and all of that. Then when I went over to Pete's place up in Granada Hills, they were all bitch players. They all looked at the music. They just stared at it and said, great tune. They sat down. Why don't we just roll tape, record it once, boom, I love that take, let's go to the next take. And they were blowing through the stuff, and it was going so fast that as an engineer, and they liked it because I can read music, so they'd sit there and go, measure 35 on the end of four, can you punch me in? One, two. And I'd be like, you know, I'm trying to figure out where they're going. I think that's important as a mixer in post and in TV and commercials. You have to. There's a certain amount of speed that has to happen. That you have to be fast, you have to know your toys. You may not know all the best toys, but at that point, you got a bag of tricks. You can go in, you can create some sounds, and even up to the $100 million movies, you know, when they're paying $1,300 an hour, you got to be fast.
Yeah.
And, you know, if you want that, oh, we need somebody coming over a PA, boom, go to the 480, the 6000, boom, there's my PA thing. There you go.
Yeah. Well, that's it. I was always had someone behind me watching you, and then when they say do this, you have to pretty much do it within a couple moves.
Yeah.
So I mean, that's a big thing. Yeah, exactly what you said. You have to be speedy. You know, you can't sit there and twiddle your thumbs and go, how am I going to do this kind of thing.
So basically, to get employed in the audio industry, you need to learn some tools. You need to find some friends, and you need to work hard,
yeah,
okay?
Yeah.
Now, and here's the thing that I want to bring up, and I want to talk to you guys about it before we close, is once you get that first gig, you got to watch out for yourself because there's a lot of guys out there that are just going to exploit you. I have a friend that I know at a post place I used to mix at. He was making $10 an hour, being a recordist for a national show, and he kind of rose up through the ranks, and he went to ask for a raise. And they wouldn't do it. And he would have been just happy for like a buck. And he was just totally in a factory situation where they're just, you know, finding these young, eager people that are going to go up through the ranks and get exploited like that.
But you know what? Use it to your advantage. I mean, I worked in one of those sweatshops.
Right.
And what's great is, you know, you come in. Look, reality, you come in, you suck. You have no experience.
Right.
You really have no clue what you're doing. But your body, they can teach you really quick. You learn something. Once you learn it, leave.
Leave. Yeah.
There's no point of trying to grow up the ladder.
That's exactly
it's like,
right.
Thank you very much. You got me cheap. I learned something from you. And then you step up to the next facility and the next and the next.
Yep.
But there's one important thing, though. Sweatshops, I think, are a very important thing because when you come to town and you work in a sweatshop, you become the class of. And I know the record plant guys, Cherokee guys, and there's a lot of post people that got used and abused. But what happens is, as you climb the ranks and go to the mid and the higher studios, you can say, oh, I used to work for so-and-so. What year? Oh, I worked for them too.
Yeah.
They sucked. Oh, my God. And then you start trading horror stories about doing all-nighters. And all of a sudden, you're bonding, and the guy you might be bonding with is the guy that you're interviewing to get a job with.
Right.
And all of a sudden, you have something in common. And I find the closest the people become is during the hard times, not the good times.
Right. Well, yeah. I'm just saying, you know, and I'll talk to Nick and Ken both about these, but you gotta watch out for yourself because there's people that are out there to exploit you. I mean, Nick, as a freelancer, I'm sure you've come across this several times.
Well, I mean, I was an editor and I didn't want to – I mean, not that I knew everything about editing, but I wanted to do something different. So – and you're exactly right. I wasn't going to ever become a mixer there, you know, because I was the editor. So what I had to do was leave and not necessarily present myself as a mixer, but just say, I want to mix. I want to come here and mix. And then you apply for mixing jobs. You know, you're not looking for the editing jobs. You're looking for a mixing job. And that's kind of what I figured is the way to go. You're not going to move up. You're not going to become an editor. You're not going to be an editor, then become a mixer, and then kind of go that way. You might find a job like that. You might find a company
like
that.
But you know what? It's very hard to overcome people's impression of what you're supposed to be, especially right. at a company like that. And like you said, if you're established there as an editor and that's what they think of you as, that's just what you're always going to be.
I came into my first mixing gig as a mixer. I was editing over at one place and it was a sweatshop. And then I said, you know what? I'm not going to do this anymore. I know enough. And boom, I jumped right in as a mixer into the next place. And ever tell you about the first time I ever mixed a national spot? Yeah, 20 minutes ago.
a certain line of bullshit doesn't hurt either.
Right.
You know, it's interesting. Sound Deluxe has, I would say, 75% of all the people I knew started as drivers.
I started from the bottom,
and they're doing huge things right now.
Yeah.
One of them is head of a post for a big major studio right now.
I started as a runner, and the person that was editing didn't know how to use a computer. I knew how to use a computer, so they said, okay, well, since you know how to use it, you're the guy. I mean, and then I wasn't necessarily exploited, but I was the $10 an hour guy working on a computer doing theatrical stuff.
I've been fortunate to see Ken's career move, and I know he went from editor to mixer and is thriving as a mixer. I mean,
I'm doing all right. Thriving.
You're doing good. I mean, you're already on a national show, and I think that's pretty good. But also, everything that you said, though, he comes from a music background, and he knows how to work the analog gear, and he's a hard worker. And the fact that he made it into the mixing chair, I think, goes to show you that you can still, there's still room for people to move up.
It takes years.
Yeah, it seems.
You've got to be able to invest time.
Exactly. A lot of people say it seems impossible to get a job in the audio industry, especially with studios going out. But there's still ways in, and programming. There's only more and more programming, more and more outlets for audio.
Yeah.
It's just a whole different paradigm.
There's plenty of work out there. I mean, you just have to – if you want to work in the business, you have to set your mind to it and go out there and get a job. I mean, I think that's just the bottom line, period.
And one thing I want to say about Nick, and I hope it's okay that I mention this, but Nick –
Not
know,
that.
No, but he also – he rents out systems and he puts systems in. So he's taken his knowledge even farther, and not only is he freelancing, but he also has Pro Tools rigs out there that are making money for him. And so it's just – there's – like you said, there's ways to make it work.
You just got to hustle. I mean, I'm a hustler, I guess, if you want
to
call it like that. But
you have to be.
Yeah. You're selling yourself, and that's – right. And you got to stay true to your word, as best as you can.
Yeah, that's huge.
Well, hey, we're going to have to wrap it up here. But, boy, this is a lively little conversation that we had here. I'd like to thank Ken Kane and Nick. Oh, man.
Kaskura. I'll help you out. You can say get your phone to say it.
That's right.
Nick, oh, man. Is that Irish?
And I just want to remind people that we are still giving away some DMP7s.
Yes, we are.
You want some free gear? A free DMP7.
Free. It's not just free gear. It's free terrible gear.
Shipping costs $200, though.
Hey, what do the DMP7s list for before they – no, shipping's free.
Oh. Shipping is free. I don't remember. They were – few thousand though,
so
a couple grand maybe.
All the sound designers out there. Here's the thing: you want to get one of those. You want to find a very tall building. You want to go up to the top of the tall building, put some mics at the bottom of the building, and record the velocity coming down. And so I mean, about different kinds of
shattering.
Shattering. Yes.
Oh man, I remember when that thing first came out. Though I was just like,
they were the coolest.
I was drooling.
Well, I got two more for you.
And Pagey Boy, how's your record coming along? It's getting pretty
good.
Close.
We're very near. We're going to be putting it out probably the beginning of the year, but getting all the processes together, all the stuff you have to do, photographs and websites and all that stuff. But it should be the beginning of the year, so I'm excited.
And I know, Scott, I know you're working hard on a couple of films, so pretty soon you'll be able to tell us what they are and when we can go see them.
There we go.
All right, well, I want to thank everybody for being on the Audio Nowcast. We'll catch you next time.
Have a question for the panel? Would you like to be a guest on the Audio Nowcast and live in the LA area? Email us at audio@nowcastnetwork.com. Thanks for listening to this week's edition of the Audio Nowcast, sponsored by Westwave Audio.